Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This podcast is about your future. What if the next years of your life can be the best years of your life? When full-time work becomes optional, you'll have the time to do all the things you've always wanted to do, if only you had the time. And soon you will. But to make the most of it, you'll need to be well prepared, and that goes well beyond your financial planning. Each week, your host, Joe Casey, is inviting you into conversations with his guests to bring you insights, inspiration, and practical ideas to design your new life, a life you'll build around what matters most to you and on your own terms. Let's get started.
Everyone wants to retire happy, but what's the roadmap to a happy, satisfying, and fulfilling retirement? Well, one factor is time, how you think about time, and how you choose to invest your time. After all, it's probably the most precious resource you'll bring to your retirement. So you'll want to make smart and wise investment decisions about it. Today, we'll be talking with Cassie Holmes, PhD. She's the author of the book, Happier Hour, How to Beat Distraction, Expand Your Time, and Focus on What Matters Most. She's a professor at UCLA's Anderson School of Management. She earned her PhD at Stanford's Graduate School of Business and her BA at Columbia as a psychology major. An award-winning teacher and researcher of time and happiness, Cassie's work has been widely published in lead academic journals and featured in such outlets as NPR, The Economist, The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, The Atlantic, and The Washington Post. Happier Hour is her first book. Cassie, thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Joe.
So, what drives happiness and what's under our control?
Yeah, big questions. And first, I want to say that when I use the term happiness, I am referring to what a psychologist and behavioral economist refer to as subjective well-being. So it is both that positive emotion, the joy you feel in the moment, as well as this cognitive evaluative component of feeling satisfied about. As I'm about to answer your question, I want folks to realize that I'm not just talking about sort of these flippant passing feelings, that happiness is really also this sort of more hefty sense of how satisfied we are in our life. Now, looking to what are the inputs? Well, there are three buckets. The first that we do not have control over is our inherited natural disposition. That is your personality, do you tend to be more cheery, seeing the glass as half full? Or are you someone who tends to feel a little bit more grumpy, noticing the empty part of any glass? So that has a significant effect. The second category is one that we also don't have, we have some control over, but not immediate control over, and that is our life circumstances. And so this includes things like income level, marital status, maybe employment status, how attractive you are. And interestingly, these circumstances tend to be the things that people think are the secrets to happiness. If only I had a whole lot more money, then I will be significantly happier and happy forever. But research shows that yes, these things do have an effect, but actually a significantly smaller effect than all of us, many of us predict. Now, the third category and last category is the one that I'm most interested in for the very reason in your question. It's the one we have the most control over. So what we think about and what we intentionally do in our day-to-day has a significant influence on our happiness, more so than those circumstances that we think are sort of the secrets to happiness. And so in my work, because I look at the role of time, I very much frame this as how do we think about and choose to invest the time that we have? How does that influence the joy that we experience in our days and the satisfaction we feel about our lives?
So in your book, Happier Hour, you have the best explanation I've ever seen of hedonic adaptation. Yeah. You could please share a story of what you learned walking your son Leo to school one day.
Yeah. So hedonic adaptation is our propensity to get used to things over time. So when you do the same thing again and again, when you're with the same person for years, we get used to them so that those circumstances stop having as much of an effect on our emotions as they initially did. Now, it's good that we are adaptive in the face of negative circumstances because it makes us resilient. The problem is that we are also adaptive even in the face of these positive circumstances and experiences and activities. And the story that I shared in the book that you're referring to was, it's in the chapter, actually, I won't say the chapter name because it might give away what the story was, but it was my first professor job was in Philly. I was an assistant professor at Wharton. And being from Southern California, I love sunshine. And so it was always a goal to get back and to raise my kids in Southern California sunshine. So when UCLA reached out and offered me a position, while I was sad to leave my colleagues at Wharton, I was really so excited to set up life in LA. And it is amazing. I mean, we have this house just off of UCLA's campus, which is a beautiful campus. And I could walk my son to school every day through this beautiful campus to his preschool, which was right next to my office. And so commute time is an activity that many people do not enjoy, but this was such a lovely commute, right? And the first couple months, I was so grateful because it was in contrast, no offense to any of the East Coasters out there, in contrast to Philly, it was just so lovely. Like the sun every day would be shining, the smell of eucalyptus trees, the birds chirping, the flip-flop wearing undergrads who were always seem smiley walking by. On one of these days, and this was probably about a year into living this lovely existence, I was walking my son to preschool. And like all those other days, it was gorgeous. And my little three-year-old was skipping along next to me, as happy as could be. And meanwhile, I'm sort of charging ahead because I am thinking about what's next. My meetings, everything I had to get done at work before I go back to pick him up. And at one point, he's like, "Mom, wait." And I'm like, "We don't have time to wait. Hurry up, Leo." And he's like, "No, Mom." And I turn around and I saw him burying his nose into this bush of white roses. And before I could stop myself out of my mouth, I was like, "Leo, we don't have time to stop and smell the roses." And when I heard those words come out of my mouth, I did stop. It was so on the nose and so ridiculous as a time and happiness expert that I am yelling at my son in this beautiful situation that we don't have time to stop and smell the roses. Because I had been passing, you know, like walking in this beautiful setting every day that I wasn't even noticing it anymore, let alone savoring it, let alone experiencing the joy that was right there in the moment if I were to only pay attention. And so that's an example of hedonic adaptation. And I mean, it shows up in a lot of ways of how do we, after years of being with your partner, the love of your life, so much so that you agreed to spend your life with them, how do we sort of continue to notice those simple joys of waking up next to them? Or how do we continue to notice the beautiful view from your window? And I share in Happier Hour several strategies to offset hedonic adaptation so that we can continue to experience the joy in our joyful activities that are already right there in the time that we're spending.
I appreciate sharing that story, theory and practice. Great awareness in the moment to stop. Yeah. So what can people learn about happiness from tracking their time?
Yeah, tracking time is, and I guess I would say to contextualize this, that really what I'm sharing the research to help people do is to maximize the amount of time that they experience as worthwhile, minimize the time that is wasted or that people are moving through almost like letting it be wasted. And there's two components of that. One is spending time, investing time on activities that are worthwhile. The other is when you're spending that time being engaged in such a way that you make those times worthwhile. So when I just mentioned some of the strategies to offset hedonic adaptation, that is to allow it so that when you're spending time on these worthwhile activities, that you get the most out of them. Now, time tracking allows you and helps you to identify what are those activities that are worth allocating time towards. Researchers in tracking use time tracking to identify what are those activities that are associated with the most positive emotion, most negative emotion, and sort of tracking over the course of people's days, what activities are they doing as well as how are they feeling? So you can pull out on average, what are those activities that tend to produce the most positive emotion? What are those activities that tend to produce the most negative emotion? That research points to, on average, the most happy, satisfying, rewarding activities tend to be those that socially connect us, that genuinely connect us with other people, whether physically, sort of through physical intimacy, but really it's about the time that you're spending fostering, cultivating those important relationships. The least happy activities on average tend to be commuting, hours spent working, as well as housework, which sadly for the sort of average working American tends to comprise the bulk of our work weeks. But I think it's important to note that this is based off of averages. So for the average American, as well as sort of the average instantiation of any given activity, but you can certainly sort of think to yourself, like, sure, there are some times that I'm socializing that are very positive and satisfying, but then there are others that are not. So what I suggest people do is actually track their own time over the course of a week, writing down, and there's a worksheet on my website and more detailed instructions in Happier Hour, but writing down for each sort of half hour increment, what is the activity you're doing and being more specific than just like family time, but what activity are you doing and which family members are there? And as importantly, rating on a 10-point scale coming out of that activity, how satisfied, how positive did you feel? And so while it can actually be somewhat tedious to do the time tracking, it's really informative because at the end of the week, you have this fantastic sort of personalized data set that you can look for yourself. What are those activities that make you happiest using your own ratings? What are those activities that make you feel the eights, nines, and tens maybe? Also, you can see what are those activities that really sort of produce less happiness or in some cases, even unhappiness. And in some cases, those aren't even necessary activities. So that's very helpful to realize that those are maybe some hours that you have available to reallocate towards more worthwhile activities. It also allows you to calculate and see just how much time you're spending on these various activities. Again, to help you identify what are potentially some ways that you're quote unquote wasting time. And not according to me, but according to your ratings, if it doesn't even produce satisfaction and enjoyment and might not even be that necessary, those are available hours that you can reallocate towards activities that you now know from your data produce a great amount of satisfaction.
In life transitions, people can go from being time poor to time rich all of a sudden. And that may sound great, but what has your research found about having too little time and having too much time?
Yeah. And I think it's a really important finding that informed some of my decision making in someone who, particularly when my kids were young and had my career as well, that feeling time poor is this acute feeling of having too much to do and not enough time to do it. And in that state, many times I was like, oh my gosh, the solution is actually to quit my job. And if only I had a whole lot more time, then I would be happier. And I know that this sort of sentiment is, as people are sort of working and the stress of their careers, they're like, as soon as I retire, then I will have a whole lot more time and then I will feel less stress and therefore happier. But the question is it true? Is it true that people who have a whole lot more discretionary time are indeed happier? And what we look, this is an empirical question and one that we explored. What's the relationship between the amount of discretionary time people have and their happiness, their satisfaction in life? Across studies, we found a consistent pattern of results. And in one of the studies, what we did was we analyzed data from the American Time Use Survey, which captured for tens of thousands of working as well as non-working Americans, how they spent a regular day. And we calculated the amount of time that they spend on discretionary activities, spending time in ways that people want versus obligations. And what we found, the pattern of results was an upside down U shape. So like an arc or a rainbow, suggesting that it goes down on both ends of the spectrum. So yes, with too little time, people are less happy because they have higher levels of stress. But what was interesting was that there is such thing as having too much available discretionary time. And digging into what drove that sort of downward slope with too much time, what it turns out is that we are driven to be productive. We're averse to being idle. So when we spend all the hours of our sort of regular days with nothing to show for how we spent those hours, it undermines our sense of purpose. And with that, we feel less satisfied. Now, notably, working for pay is not the only source of spending time in ways that allow folks to feel productive and worthwhile. For me, it was. So that is sort of like telling me in those daydreaming states, do not quit your job, because for me, actually, my work is a great source of fulfillment. But it is important to recognize that having the available discretionary hours in your day, what one needs to do is invest those hours in ways that allow them to feel productive, to give a sense of purpose. So we actually found folks who had a whole lot of discretionary time, when they spent them in ways that for them felt worthwhile, that it included things engaging in an enriching hobby that allowed you to develop and grow, engaging in volunteer work that allowed you to feel like you were having an impact, also engaging in social connections, cultivating those important relationships, you actually didn't see this dip in happiness with a lot of time. So what this is pointing to is that the solution to happiness or satisfaction is not actually being time rich. It's about making the time that you have rich. It's about investing the hours in your days in ways that feel fulfilling. And yes, you do need some available hours to spend in those ways, or else, you know, you don't want to be in the time poor end of the spectrum, but you have to be wary and cautious when you do have a lot of available time to be intentional about investing in ways that feel worthwhile.
Are you delaying your retirement? Many people are, but don't delay your preparation. Use this time wisely to get ahead of the game. Explore new options for your next chapters. Take a look at the link in our show notes for the Designing Your Life small group coaching program. Two new groups starting in late January. Early bird pricing is available until December 31st. So take a look at it now and hope to see you soon. So it's really all about that meaning and purpose wired to be productive, not idle, as you said. And your book has a ton of very helpful exercises. What's one you'd recommend for someone listening who's in perhaps a life transition? They're time rich, but they want to find that sweet spot, that Goldilocks just right combo where they'll feel engaged, fulfilled, and happy.
Yeah. And from that, I think actually sort of pulling some of the points that we've talked about already is figuring out what are those ways of spending for you that you can identify through time tracking that are satisfying. And a lot of it is be very aware of the role of social connection. And when you're doing your time tracking, look at not just what are those social activities, but what are those ways of engaging? Like actually looking, it's not just the category of activity, but what are some commonalities across your most positive activities? Because then you can pull out, for instance, maybe it is that actually being outside is that common thread. And so with that, ensuring and prioritizing and scheduling time in your weeks so that you have enough time outside. Maybe it's about not socializing in groups, but maybe for you, it's that one-on-one time that is really connecting. And then, so that is informative to make sure that you set up lunches, dinners, coffees with individuals. Like even, it might even be within your family that actually you find that the one-on-one time is really satisfying. Whereas what you get everyone in a group, maybe you don't have that sort of opportunity for a really good conversation. So prioritizing time for those really connecting activities. Also thinking about what is your purpose? Like what really does drive you? And that doesn't necessarily have to be tied to a job, but it can, and it does influence and speak to what motivates you intrinsically, genuinely to do what you do. And there's an exercise in the book, the five whys, which helps you sort of uncover like, you know, I do these things, but why am I really doing them? And when you ask yourself five layers of why to your own answers to those questions, it really reveals what motivates you. And so with that, you can also make sure that you choose activities, make time for, schedule activities that help you serve your purpose, like that help you work towards those higher level goals, because that's where you get the sense of meaning. That's where you get the sense of satisfaction that we need in order to sort of look back on our days, look back on our weeks, look back on our years without regret, and instead with a sense of satisfaction and fulfillment.
So in order to focus our time on what matters most, what we find most meaningful, learning to say no is an important skill. What have you learned about how and when to say no?
Yeah, so it's important because it's very easy to say yes in the moment, but then the effects of that on you later prove to be quite taxing. There's a very sort of neat research by some of my colleagues, Gal Zuberman and John Lynch, where they ended up calling the effect the yes dam effect. But it's basically picking up on the fact that today we feel like we have less available time than we think that we will have in that same day, sort of a month from now. That is, we think that we will have more available time in the future than we have today. And therefore, we're like, it's easy to say yes, because in the month where I have to show up for that event, then I will have more time. But in fact, that day is just going to be like today, because once you get there, you will have said yes to all these, you know, commitments, and they are all right there. And yes, that day too is only 24 hours long, and you still need, you know, your time sleeping. And so we overcommit for our future selves. And then when we get there, we're like, that's why it's the yes damn. We get there, we're like, damn, I don't have time today and I don't want to be doing this. So what we should use is filters, whether it's the purpose filter, that knowing what is important to you and sort of what drives you, to figure out what you should say yes to, what you should say no to. Your happiness filter too, from the time tracking, that really allows you to pull out what are those ways of spending and activities that are satisfying for you, And particularly if you do have actual discretion in how you spend your time, which we all do have much more so than we might think, then use that filter for you to identify what to say yes to, what to say no to.
What are some of the associations between age and happiness?
So in my work, what we've actually found is sort of even beyond the level of happiness that one feels at different ages, which actually I would say researchers looking at those questions, there is some divergence in conclusions. What I have found in my work, which I actually think is very helpful to keep in mind, is that the way we experience happiness changes over the course of our lives, as does the experiences that make us most happy. So in my work, we looking at sort of really interesting millions of data points using blog data and expressions of I feel or I'm feeling happy of people expressing it sort of unsolicited. What we find is that there's sort of these two clumps of happiness. There's excited happiness, and then there's this sort of calm, contented, serene happiness. And what we found is that younger people tend to express excited happiness. As you get older, you're more likely to express and experience that calm, contented happiness. Now, that's not to say that older people do not feel excited happiness. It's just looking at the proportions of them shifts. And one of the underlying factors actually came out in some of my later work, where we were looking at what are the experiences that contribute to our greatest happiness. And we were looking at the happiness from extraordinary experiences like life milestones, once in a lifetime vacations, going, you know, to concerts or super best restaurants of the world type thing, versus more ordinary experiences, those simple moments shared with loved ones, noticing nature, enjoying a treat, you know, whether it's like a yummy sandwich or a nice glass of wine. And what we found was that age influenced the happiness from these different types of experiences. Now, extraordinary experiences actually make everyone happy. They produce greater happiness. When you look at younger people, though, they experience greater happiness from extraordinary experiences than ordinary experiences. In terms of the happiness from these ordinary experiences, as people get older, they experience greater happiness from these ordinary experiences, such that among older people, you find that they feel and experience as much happiness from these ordinary, simple moments as they do the extraordinary experiences. And the underlying factor is actually, as people get older, it becomes very salient to them that time is limited. And with recognizing just how precious our time is, it makes us savor more. Notice those moments. So, you know, we talked about hedonic adaptation. When we recognize that our time left is limited, that draws our attention to those moments. It helps offset hedonic adaptation. So even though as we age, we naturally recognize the more limited nature of our time and savor those ordinary experiences more, even younger people, when they are led to count the number of times they have left, to recognize that time in life is limited, then you actually see that young people too enjoy an enormous amount of happiness from these simple, ordinary moments.
You mentioned regrets before, and regrets, I've had a few. Tell us about the distinction you make in your book, Happier Hour, between regrets that come from actions and regrets that come from inaction, things we didn't do but wanted to.
Yeah, and this is really interesting work, not done by my lab, but folks, Tom Gilovich and his colleagues, looking at what are those things that people regret. And as you mentioned in your question, there's two sort of categories of regrets. Regrets of something I did and I wish I didn't. So regrets of action. I said that and I wish I didn't. I took that job and I wish I didn't. Then there's also regrets of inaction. I wish I had done that thing that I didn't do. I wish I had said something. I wish I had pursued that job. What's interesting is the time course of these regrets. So regrets of action are severe, and so we address them and they don't stick around. So like I said something I shouldn't have, and it's very clear to me that I messed up. So I apologize. And so it's sort of rectified. So regressive action are severe, but short-lived because we address them. The regressive inaction are sort of insidious because they creep up on you. There wasn't something that actually happened that you need to fix. And so what happens is we don't end up, you know, like one of the examples I said, I wish I had said something. I wish I had said thank you to that person. I wish I had told that person how much they mean to me. I wish I had taken that job or pursued that career, but time passes and there's nothing so acute that we generally tend to address. So actually, if you look, the regrets that people are more likely to express at the end of their life and at the end of their lives are regrets of inaction. So I wish I didn't spend time in those ways with those people in the ways that I wanted. I wish I had said thank you. I wish I had. And so actually a lot of the learnings and the sort of points in the book is to compel us, to motivate us to go ahead and act in these ways that will leave us without those regrets of inaction, that make us go ahead and invest, have those conversations for those really important relationships, to go ahead and invest our time on these pursuits that do allow us to sort of fulfill our purpose and our personal big goals, so that at the end, we don't look back and sort of wish we had.
One thing that got my attention besides all of your research was your interest in life design. And wondering, how can people use life design to zoom out and be intentional with our choices about time?
Yeah. And zooming out, I mean, there's sort of different layers of zooming out. First, it's the layer of zooming out from like thinking hour by hour to taking a step back and thinking about your week. So I talk about how do you design an ideal week, looking at those hours as tiles within a mosaic, and how do you piece the hours of your week together so that it's not questions of whether I engage in this or not. It's really about when do I invest and engage in these various pursuits that are important to you. But then you can step back even further, zooming out and looking not just across your week, but across your years, across your life. And what that highlights is, again, that there is this beautiful mosaic that it's, you don't have to be monochromatic, that it's not like everything is work or everything is family, that in fact, you can weave those together and maybe think about your life as different chapters where you sort of dial up one color, again, taking the mosaic analogy, where you think in terms of colors, maybe for a chapter of your life. And actually, research points to that we tend to think of our chapters in life in 4 or 5 year increments. And sort of thinking about what colors do I want to sort of put more of those tiles for this particular chapter? And then in the next chapter, maybe I'll sort of change the proportions of the colors. But seeing it all together takes away the sort of assumed trade-offs between our priorities. And in fact, allows us to sort of play out. Of course, we can't be everything and do everything in a given hour, but you can across your hours. And again, it's a question of when, not whether.
One last question. I know this is sometimes a hard one, but what's the one key message you'd like people to take away from your book, Happier Hour?
I think it actually highlights that there's a lot of happiness in available in the time that we're already spending. And so making sure that we are intentional in protecting the time for those things, but also paying attention while we're spending that time so that we don't miss out on the happiness that's right there in the time that we're already spending.
Thank you so much for spending time with us. Great book, a lot of very useful exercises, great research. And also, I appreciate the way you wove in so many personal stories into the book. You've made it a very rich mosaic.
Well, thank you so much.
Time for takeaways, three ideas you can put into action following this podcast conversation today. It's hard to narrow it down to three today because there are so many actionable ideas that came up in this conversation with Cassie Holmes. But here are three I'd recommend. Number one, your happiness is much more under your control than perhaps you think. As she mentioned, studies have shown that there's three components. There's our natural disposition that you can't do too much about. There's our circumstances. And then third, our choices. So think about the choices slice of that pie. How can you change up and shift some of the choices you make in the new year ahead? Number two, track your time. Not forever, just for a week, as Cassie Holmes recommends. I've seen people do this. I've done it myself. I had one of my executive coaching clients about 10 years ago volunteer this as an exercise, and he got a tremendous amount out of it, and I've recommended other clients do the same. There's something about getting the data for yourself about how you're actually making choices about how to allocate your time. So do it for a week, take a look at it, and identify ways for you to identify and maximize your happier hours. You'll find a link in the show notes to the worksheet on her website. Number three, prevent one regret of inaction. That was a big nugget in her book for me in terms of things that we regret doing because we didn't do them have a more lasting effect than those things we regretted doing. So think about with the new year ahead, what's one thing? Could be a small thing, could be an intermediate thing, could be a big thing. What's one thing you might regret if you don't do it in the new year? Write it down. Think about how you might be able to take one step, just one small step toward that this month to prepare for moving forward and preventing that regret in the future. Thanks for listening to the Retirement Wisdom Podcast.
Just one more thing before you take off. Is it time to design your new life after you graduate from the world of full-time work? Go to retirementwisdom.com and schedule a call today with Joe Casey. Working with an experienced coach like Joe can help you explore new possibilities and gain clarity on your future. Thank you for listening to the Retirement Wisdom Podcast. See you next week.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar-S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.